You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is a publication of Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org. Hello, you're listening to Off Script, American Theater's podcast for all things theatrical. I'm Allison Considine, the staff writer. We're doing something a little different this episode. Earlier this week, we had a live event at the Robert Moss Theater in New York City in celebration of our January issue, which was all about directing training. We had a panel discussion that included Ann Bogart, Ann Kaufman, Rachel Chavkin, and Liesl Tommy. The conversation was recorded for Facebook Live, and the audio is now available for you today. In the future, American Theater will be doing more live events and recording them. So thank you for listening. Enjoy the show. And as always, rate us on iTunes. So we have some very exciting guests here this evening. Right here we have Ann Kaufman. She's directed at the New York Theater Workshop, Playwrights Horizons, Roundabout Theater Company, most recently there with Marvin's Room, which was on Broadway last season. And she was recently named the co-artistic director of New York City Center's Encores Off-Center program. It was a mouthful. So next we've got Rachel Chavkin, the founding artistic director of the Brooklyn-based company The Team, and she directed Natasha Pierre in The Great Comet of 1812 at Ars Nova, Casino, and on Broadway. And then next to her is Ann Bogart, the co-founder and co-artistic director of New York City's City Company and director of Columbia University's MFA directing program. We've got Liesl Tommy with us tonight. She's directed all over the country, including at Dallas Theater Center, Yale Repertory Theater, Berkeley Repertory Theater. Her New York credits here include Eclipsed on Broadway. And next up is Relevance at MCC Theater, which starts February 1st. So welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks. So we're going to kick off. This is kind of a big question, but professionals often find their place in the theater industry by way of performing. So I was just curious what your pathway was to directing and why directing? Why did you want to be behind the scenes calling the shots? So anyone can jump in there.
I guess I'll start. I wanted to be a musical theater star. I really thought I was going to be a musical theater star. I still would like to be a musical theater star. But I became very, you'll hire me, right? You guys will hire me. It became very clear, slowly, not quickly, it became very clear over 18 years that I didn't have the talent. Or as it turns out, the interest. I got very bored. I realized being in things. My mind wandered and I lost interest. So the fact that it was clear that I didn't have the talent, coupled with my boredom, and being a kind of control freak, that combination led me to directing in college. So I think as a kid I'm one of six children, and I was always sort of like putting on little, making people do things.
Bossing people around.
What's that?
Bossing people around.
That's it, thank you. Bossing people around from a very early age. So I just sort of came into my infancy then again later, re-meeting myself as the bossy control freak that was interested in the bigger picture.
Can go that
We're going
way.
Down the line.
Sure. Bossy was a big thing. I played sports all while growing up.
So you are bossy, plays. Rachel.
I'm very bossy. I trained as an actor all through college. I loved it. I loved performing. I went on my first audition, and I was horrified. I just absolutely hated it, and I was auditioning, I think, for an unpaid Shakespeare gig in... That was, I think, happening in Jersey, which that's fine. But all I wanted, I knew more about Shakespeare than anyone behind the table, and I wanted to tell them that. And I walked out, and I was like, "This is not for me." And I never went on another audition again. And I had been working had studied directing in college here at Playwrights Horizons, and had begun making my own work at school, and I just kept doing that.
I never, ever, ever, ever wanted to act, ever, ever, ever. And I started doing the theater because I was brought up in the Navy, and we moved every year or 2 years. And I always was lost in these big schools, and I would find there was some place, some pocket of a room or a place where theater was made, and all the right things happened. And I never acted. Well, I had to act in The Lottery. I remember that. Remember that play, yes. The Lottery? But mostly I was helping out, getting passes out of class so I could look for props. You know, they don't stop you in the hallways. And what would happen is you fall madly in love with everybody, and then it's over. And that made a lot of sense to me because that was what my life was like. I would fall in love with everybody, and then we're told we're moving to Japan. You know, so it was a way of repeating what I knew already, but never wanted to act really. But what I do have is I adore and hero worship actors, and I can't believe what they have to do on the stage, and I like to watch them fly. All the things I can't do physically, I was never very gifted physically. I always tried to do things, you know, all the athletics and dance, and but I was always throwing myself across the space with no technique. Well, I tried to learn technique, I just can't do it. So I admire actors, and but to act, never, ever, ever, ever.
I always wanted to be an actor. I started off as a dancer. I took ballet for many, many, many years, and then I became an actor. I discovered acting, you know, in my teens when my family immigrated to the States. And it, for me, it was a salvation. The transition from South Africa to the States was a horrific transition, but I found that in theater you had an immediate community. And fellow actors was an immediate group of friends. And once I discovered it, I never looked back. It's the only thing I wanted to do, and I pursued it ferociously. You know, I studied Chekhov with Russians. I went to England to study Shakespeare. I went to graduate school for acting. It was, you know, the only thing that I wanted to do. But when I was in graduate school, the teachers there said that they thought I should be directing as well. And they made sure that I directed something every year. And sure enough, once I got to New York, I realized that as an actor, you have no control over content. And that was a deal breaker for me as a political person. And so that's when I switched completely to directing and never looked back.
That's great. So once directors find that this is what they want to be doing, the next step is training. So Anne Bogart, this question is for you. You've been at the helm of the MFA program at Columbia for a number of years. So I was just curious how the approach to directing...
25, thank 25. You very much.
So I was just curious what the approach to directing, how that has changed over the course of that time.
Yeah, you know, this sounds like a joke, but it isn't actually... I think the one thing you can train a director in terms of technique is that the strongest line on stage is a diagonal. It always works. It's emotional. And I joke, say, you learn that, okay, poof, you have your master's degree in directing. So, but what you can provide is the circumstances in which the directors put work in front of audiences every single week of their training, whether the audiences are their people they live with in their apartments or people they drag in off the street. But I think you only learn how to direct in front of an audience because you're the first audience, and then you bring these other people in and you get incredibly embarrassed by what you've put up and you run out of all your director tricks. And so I think the training is a chance to actually put work up, not assist, not... be theoretical, not with model boxes, but to literally put something in front of an audience and you go through the humiliation of it not working, where you really feel it's just not working and what do I have to adjust? And you do it on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. And for my piece, I spoke in American theater, I spoke to Robert O'Hara as well, and he studied under you.
Well, he knows how to make a diagonal line.
He does know how to make a diagonal line.
I would like add to that, like levels, like diagonal, and levels, then like yeah. That's what I learned in one class yeah. early on too. That you can higher and lower yeah, also yeah. means
that's right.
That was actually mm-hmm. great. So one of Robert O'Hara's biggest takeaways from you, Anne, was finding his directorial voice and you shepherding the students through that process of finding the kind of work that they want to do. So I wanted to open that up to all of you. What was that process of discovering and developing your own voice and style?
I had probably the best class I ever had in undergrad was a class that happened on Sunday nights from 7 to 10 p.m. And you weren't graded for it. You weren't required to show work in it every week. It was like you could come and do as you were. And the class was called COW, which stood for Creating Original Work. And the only assignment was to be interesting alone on stage for 10 minutes. At the end of the semester, and some people would like slowly chip away each week at a central idea that they were developing. Some people would bring in a new thing every week, and then they would chuck out the entire thing and then come in with a wholly new 10-minute piece. And then some people didn't show once the entire semester, and then would do either crap or brilliance at the end of the semester, and I think we would just drink and eat and talk about each other's work, and it was taught by a experimental choreographer named Marlene Pennison, it's something that you have certainly said to me in terms of just like being in the crisis of your own space. That I don't know that I would say I got articulate about my. I don't necessarily like the idea that I have one voice as a director because I work on such different projects, but I certainly developed process in that class. And that was ultimately what Marlene was most interested in teaching, was the muscle to develop a working process so that at the end of the semester you had some idea of what you were going to put up and maybe, if not how it would be received, at least what it meant to you to do that work.
Can I throw down something about the word style, which you used? I propose that style is very, very dangerous, and that a director should never work on a style. It's other people who will end up saying, oh, that's your style. But the minute you start thinking about creating a style, you're in big trouble.
I think it's, Rachel, it's so interesting to hear you say that you found your voice through COW, because I was actually I read the article today, and the thing that, because I'm in the article too, and I'd forgotten that I'd said that I'd found my voice somehow in this sort of class that I took in graduate school that was a site-specific class. I would say I'm still trying to find my voice. I feel like my voice changes all the time. I feel like what's interesting is Anne and Rachel, and I think probably to a certain degree, I don't know, Liesl, but you guys are divisors. You guys devise. And I am not I'm not a divisor. I mean, I work with civilians, and that is a kind of devising company, but it's not sort of in the same sort of spirit, I think, as you guys do. But I guess what I'm thinking about is like where I found myself was or where I started to understand who I am, because mostly I work on other people's texts, you know, is having to come at something where you are writing, and by writing I don't necessarily mean like writing, but that you are responsible for content. Which is what I think a director does anyway all the time. I mean, I think that we write a production, you know, I feel very strongly about that, but I don't think I understood that. That what I'm doing is bringing a kind of text to it as well. So, but by taking this site-specific class, we took Medea pieces, Medea material, sorry, you know, the Heiner Mueller, Medea material, and Les Waters told us each that we needed to make a performance art piece from like four lines of text, you know, and we had to come in and it had to be, I don't know, there was a bunch of things that had to be included, but we had to sort of create our own piece, which is terrifying to me because I'm so reliant on, you know, a text or someone else's story. But it was a really, really important way of getting underneath you know, the sort of like really understanding where my images, where the images for the text is coming from, and the fact that I actually had to perform it myself. I mean, you were talking about, yes, I had to perform it myself. It's actually a very hilarious moment because I had a new kitten, and I decided that one of the things I was going to do was put cat food on my body and bring my kitten in. And part of this was going to be the cat was going to. I wanted the cat to look.
That's
like
the
it was,
definition of performance art.
It is, right? But because I wanted the cat to look like it was eating me, you know what I mean? But it was like in a space that was like this, and it's a kitten. You know, and you know, and I put the cat food on me, and the kitten was like nowhere. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it was nowhere to be found. Like, it never came even close to me. You know what I mean? So, which was also important. But in any case, I think I would say two things. I think that having to sort of create my own piece was the beginning of it, and to also know that I am continuing to figure out what who the fuck I am as an artist and as a thinker.
It's great.
What was the question again?
Sorry.
No.
I got myself.
The discovery of your voice and how you developed it as a director.
I think spending so many years in a rehearsal room as an actor, because I never really took a directing class, but I, you know, like I said, I was an obsessive person of the theater. I would go to rehearsals that I wasn't called at. I would go to tech, you know, at Trinity, which is where I went to grad school, and watch, you know, other people's things. I just there was just not one single part of the process that wasn't interesting to me. And also Trinity Rep, where I went to grad school, there is a thing called the Trinity style, which is a very actor-driven, you know, style. It's very vigorous, and that kind of matched up with my natural inclination also, you know, having been an athlete and a dancer, just sort of a physical ferocity was a big part of what I did. And as I moved into directing, because it comes from a pretty cerebral place in terms of the political part of it. What I figured out for me was to marry the political intellectual part of the projects that attracted me with a very physical approach, I guess. And you know, the thing I always say to my students is you just have to really know what you like and then put it on stage. And when I felt very afraid and very lost in the beginning because I didn't really know how to talk to designers, I didn't really know what any of that part of it was, I just had to trust myself and trust my taste. And so that, I guess, is how my thing developed, was just really passionately caring about the content and knowing something about how to be an actor on stage, how to move and how to block yourself, and that sort of contributed to my process, I guess.
You know, that occurs to me that one of the most profound things I ever heard was from a Russian actress who said the simplest thing in the world, and I think it's indicative of a big problem we have in this country, and you just said it when you said you learn how to block yourself as an actor. She said I'm going to say it with a Russian accent, but no, I can't. She said, the actor's job is to direct the role. And I thought, oh my God, so many directors think that it's their job to direct the role, and so many actors think it's the director's job to direct the role. In fact, it's the actor's job to direct the role and the director's job to direct the play. Mm-hmm. And I think the confusion between that has caused massive misunderstandings and real problems. So I'm glad you said about directing yourself or blocking yourself.
This is kind of related to that, but when you do get a script for a project, what is the first thing that you do as a director? Are you thinking about the design? Are you putting your dream cast together? Where do you begin in starting to direct the play?
I'll just start since I was talking, and I keep talking.
Go for it.
I actually choose projects to a large extent for a group of actors, since I have a company, and I try to imagine what I could see them in. So it's not like I start with a project and then think about casting. I think, what could this group of people attempt now that we've never done before that would take us into territory that makes us incredibly insecure?
I think that I think about, and I mean, it's in the act of reading it, and sometimes it'll take me a couple reads to do this, but try to figure out what, like, the, I don't know, the metabolism, the texture, like what the quality of the world, I guess, is, and which ends up being the stepping stone to design. Mm-hmm. Definitely, every element of the design streams from trying to capture or manifest that vibe in some way. But just, yeah, I would say first and foremost, it's trying to feel in a physical sensation what the plays or music's vibe is, and then that is gonna dictate every collaborator that feels right for the project, and certainly how the design functions.
Yeah, I would say the first thing I think about is who the designers will be, who I think would really, you know, flourish and do their like best ever work on that particular piece. I try to do as little work as possible for as long as possible.
That's called procrastination.
No, it's not procrastination. I really feel like making sure that I'm not telling people how to do their jobs. You know, so that I call the designers the first responders. I never ever tell designers what I think it is. I always let them tell me first. You know, so yeah, sometimes, you know, I used to lead with casting, but then that doesn't help you or help me. So it's really just about like the fun casting is the designers.
I would agree with that. I do procrastinate, though. I do as little as possible for as long as possible because I don't like being alone with myself in a play. I'm in a very collaborative field. I mean, I you know, I'm not a painter, I'm not a novelist, and it's a painful realization that it feels painful to me because I don't feel like my brain is big enough to do those things on my own. I actually do really need a community of people to talk to about things. And so I'm with you, Liesl. The first thing I do is I have a conversation with my designers. I think the first responders is a great way of talking about them. I think that they're the best dramaturgs. It's really the design process, which is not just about like four walls. You know, it's not, my design process never starts with what we need or whatever. It always starts with a conversation about what it feels like and what it, you know, it's a process to actually get to an idea of what even the space should be. But that exchange is really, really rich, and everything actually follows from that, for sure. Because I don't understand a play until I understand what the space that it is in. So nothing can happen until I understand what that space is, and it takes a while to understand what that space is. And the space is metaphor. So even if it's like a house, I mean, even if it's like a room, that room is not just a room. It's, you know, it's an emotional space. So, and then everything emanates from that.
So I'm so nervous always about being boring to the designers on the first meeting that I come with the full design ready to go, because I'm like, and then I presume that it'll get better and different and all of that. But like, I think I have so much anxiety about not having a visual sensibility.
You should relax.
I know.
you really should, because I don't know. Do you guys like see things when you read plays? I do not see things. You probably see things, right? You see the room. I don't see shit when I read a play. Everyone's like, what do you see? You know?
Do you hear?
No. I read it. No, I don't know what I do. I don't know why. Am I conscious? I have no idea what happens. I really don't. I wish I had like this artistic. I just don't. No, nothing. A conversation has to happen. A conversation happens with the playwright or with, you know, with the designer. But I'm just here to say, like, I feel like you're clearly a very visual person. I think, actually, if you look at my work, I think people probably think I'm kind of a visual person, right?
I think you're a visual person. Yeah.
I think but I don't see anything. I don't, you know what I mean? But, yeah. I actually was her teacher, actually, remember? Yeah. I was. I mean, yeah.
So I'm just continuing.
So the process before rehearsal start is usually much longer for the director than everybody else involved. And it really is just a long game of building a career, as Anne, you and I spoke for the story. So Liesl, I just wanted to direct this one to you. You've directed regionally all over. You made your Broadway debut with Eclipsed. Earlier this year, you directed a television episode on Oprah Winfrey's network. So I just wanted to ask you, like, what is a breakthrough experience for you, and what does that look like as a director? Have you hit it yet?
What does that mean, a breakthrough?
Well, I think, as I've learned through this story, it's harder as a director to have markers that you hit for success. So I'm just curious what that looks like. Everybody's path is very wayward as a director. I feel like there's not a step one to step two. So what was that for you? Or did you not?
The first, thank you. This is a good question. The most important, and for those of you who are, I don't know where everybody is in their careers, but my first goal was to actually be able to stop directing readings and workshops and stage a play. Because I felt like in New York, there was a period where all I was doing, I was on the reading workshop circuit. And
that's not art.
No, I don't even know what that is. Now when people ask me to direct a reading, I'm like, nope, I don't, I'm sure you don't need me there for that. You know, because it was brutal. It was never ending, and it's so unsatisfying, and and it was years of my life. So when I finally, I did my own stuff. Like, I did a lot of downtown stuff, fringe stuff. I self-produced all of that stuff off Broadway. And that was, heaven. But in terms of, like, somebody offering you a job, I did a lot of workshops and readings at other theaters, right? So when I finally started to get hired to direct actual plays, that was obviously a big deal. That was, I always sort of look for the, like, if you achieve this, then it means you should keep going. That's how I thought about it. So, like, when I went to grad school, I had gotten an audition at the Huntington. I was living in Boston at the time, and I was acting all over small films and, the smaller theaters in Boston. But when I got the call for the Huntington, I think I was like 24, I thought, oh, okay, so if the Huntington wants me to act in their theater, then I should go to grad school. Because that means that I'm on the right track. The Huntington wouldn't ask me to come and audition if I wasn't a good actor. That's how I thought about it. And so I always, like, oh, if I got to here, then that means I should, make sure my training and my technique and my thinking is going to prepare me for the road, I guess. So that was the first thing. The whole kind of journey is in reaction to failure and thwarted dreams, I guess is how I look at it. My first kind of big show in New York was this play called The Good Negro, written by Tracy Scott Wilson at the Public. And I thought, the reviews were good. People really loved it. It did very, very well in terms of sales and all of that stuff. And I thought, oh, great. People are going to see what I have to offer, and I will, maybe get another job. And then I didn't work in New York again for 5 years. Because what I realized is what I had to offer wasn't of any value in New York at the time to New York theaters. And the stuff that I was working on had no value. So I had to find the places where what I had to say and what I did had value, and that's where I cultivated my regional career and my international career. I was able to do much more experimental stuff in Canada and overseas. And I had, you know, I had built relationships with certain artistic directors regionally, and so that's, you know, that's how I kind of did that. And then 5 years later, I came back to New York. But you know, it was always just like, okay, well, that's not happening. So where is it happening? I've never been. I think a great danger of this field is to just like live in your in the rejection, because the rejection is a fact of life. You just have to keep on doing your work, and you have to keep on finding the people who value your voice. You know, so it was just it's constantly when I hit a wall, and the, you know, the thing is, you hit a wall in the middle of a triumph, right? So it's just what it is. So when, you know, so doing Broadway last year, and I think that was a fairly successful project. But I also realized that as a woman of color, again, the same thing that happened with The Good Negro, I'm not going to be necessarily one of those directors that's going to be directing a couple of shows on Broadway every year. That's just not going to be, you know, once I got through that that door. So then, well, what else am I going to do? That feels as sort of lucrative, and also has the scope that I want to be working at. So that was when I started doing television, moving into television, film and television, I guess. But it's just, you know, I cannot accept no, and I cannot, as much as the dominant culture wants to marginalize my voice just from being oblivious to it, it cannot be a thing that I accept. So that's how I've moved my way through this business.
That's great. I think it was Ed Iskandar in my story that said, directing is the loneliest profession in the world. So I was just curious, too, how directors are building these communities that that they have. I mean, I think, Anne, you said you started to really get familiar with more playwrights when you were starting out. And I know for Ed, it was maintaining and building these relationships with producers. And for some, it was like latching onto a group of actors that would champion their work. So I'm just curious how you each kind of started off when you were first starting your career, who you looked to build that community when you did hit a wall.
You know, I think it's different for every director. I think each of us, I would ask each of us, who do you want to go to the bar with afterwards? Meaning, like, some directors love to hang out with playwrights. It's like, that's who they want to hang out with. And that's also how they work. Some people want to go to the bar with the designers, because that's where their heart lies. That's who they get crushes on. And I've always wanted to go to the bar with the actors. I like love actors, and I think I don't think there's any solution to the loneliness. But I think the loneliness is really, really good, because it demands that you have to go deep inside yourself and come back to your collaborators with something original. And but at the same time, you gravitate in certain directions. Now, Lisa Peterson is a great playwright's director, and I have always admired that she can say things like to a playwright, you know, you've got a problem in your second act. And I could never say that to a playwright. I always think the playwright's play is perfect. Mm-hmm. And then they'll figure it out while they're watching me struggle with it, what they need to do, you know, because I'll say that it's perfect, but I just can't quite get it, or they see the actors struggling. So I think there are different proclivities. Probably each of us has a very, would go to the bar with a different part of the team.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, mostly I'm at the bar with designers, definitely. But I think also, like, thinking about the team, my company, our company, it's sort of anyone who, like, wants to talk endlessly about the piece and make it better. Like, it's right. All I want to do at the bar. And so I'm not good at small talk with, and yeah. So it's sort of anyone who's just ready to talk about the piece until 3 a.m.
Well spoken.
So in addition to barmates, and you spoke to this about me, to me about this, but there's certain programs and resources that are available to directors. What did you find most helpful to you as you created your career?
I feel like my bowels just froze up. It's so interesting. What programs as I'm coming through? It's interesting because I feel very passionate about figuring out how to help emerging directors. Mm-hmm. I think that it is an impossible path. I think, as Anne said, we all take our own, we all find our, sort of climb up that mountain in our own ways. And there are amazing programs. I mean, the director, Drama League is really, it was really important for me. I mean, I'm, Club Thumb and NYU and Ken Rushmull and I and are, have an emerging directors program. I don't know. I'm a little bit at a loss because what do we need? We need space. We need time. We need resources. We need it all. Every other discipline needs just a part of that, and we kind of need it all. And it's a huge challenge. I don't know quite how to chip away at it. And also, I think I said in the article too, we are all trained. We're trained, or Liesl, you trained as an actor, no one's going to come see our grad show and then hire us from that. It's a long gestation what we do, because it's not just about the work on the stage. It's about how are you in the room, how are you with producers, how are you being able to, how are you able to sort of connect all the dots? I mean, directors we're responsible for so many layers and sort of how can a program actually provide all of that? And, so I'm starting to think that maybe programs need to take on a certain part of the thing, rather than provide. You're launching, no one can launch.
Well, because it would be like trying to teach directing technique, which doesn't exist either. So, other than a diagonal and levels. So, that would be criminal to actually try to imply that there was a way to direct would be awful. So there's not going to be one program, but the idea of the piecemeal I find very reassuring in terms of just like time in the ecosystem. And I really hate the word career because it does imply that there's like a cleanliness or path to something. Even what you want your quote unquote career to look like, I think probably is going to change from year to year, if not trimester to trimester. It does feel like there's moments of impact.
Yeah, I like this idea of being in the ecosystem. I mean, I sit down with so many young directors and they want to know, how did you do it? And I always just feel so
sad. I always want to cry.
Sad.
When they ask me, I want to cry.
I actually feel like I want to cry right now, but I think it's, because I tell them the same programs, and the programs are fantastic, and everyone should apply to them or whatever, but, they take 4 a year, and they provide a certain, the ecosystem is interesting because, and being inside of it, because I feel like what I would like to do right now is to go back to grad school. I mean, I think the problem with directing and overall is we don't have time to develop. As artists, we should be continuing to develop and develop and develop. So actually, I'm an emerging director. I'm actually sick of being in a rehearsal room right now, to be honest with you. I'm really sick of it, and I'm trying to figure out, I don't want to abandon directing, but so what is the next stage? What is my next, and I think it's about I think the problem for me is I'm making work the same way all the time.
Liesl said something amazing, which I think, I can't paraphrase it, but it was when Huntington said, you're good enough to audition here, you said, oh, I can do that, so I better go to grad school. And then you continue your career, and I was thinking as you were saying that, I need to think, that way, even though I'm ancient, is to say, I got that far, that means I have to go here. And I think that is the best piece of directing advice I've ever heard, which is check out when you actually feel like that's something I can do, and then take a huge leap. Which in a way was maybe leaving New York. Mm.
But for me, it's also taking a left-hand turn. Like, it's like, I'm here, and now I'm like, ugh, is this really the rest of my, you know what I mean? Like, what is the, and this country, I feel like we're just, I don't know, it's like we're forced to be the same thing over and over again. And I feel like, what's the next turn?
Well, one of the things that I've done is make sure that, I make sure that I direct Shakespeare, I make sure that I direct musicals, I make sure I direct new musicals, and make sure that I direct, classics, because, again, it's in response to no. You know, people always think they know what you should be doing, and I know what I should be doing. And if I don't know, I'll figure it out. But I also felt, to make a living in this business as a director, the workload you have to take on is insane. To actually make a half decent living, I think the average, what's the number? The average director in America makes $15,000 according to the union statistics. So think about that for a minute. So in order to make an actual living, you are on a runaway train towards burnout. It's inevitable. So when you get to where we are, if you are not finding a way to rejuvenate and to take care of the spirit, you're in trouble. You're really in trouble. And so one of the things I did this year is after I did a Scottish play in May, and I took the rest of the year off from being in rehearsal room, did workshops and so on. But I just felt like I was in danger of losing the joy. And for me, the whole thing is about love and joy, love of my fellow man, human being. And if I don't have that, then I shouldn't be doing anything. So I just did it, and I found myself after a very good year of 2016, having to worry about money again, and all of those things. But the time away was non-negotiable for me. And that's when I also kind of like went to LA and looked, poked around in the film and television world. And I started rehearsal for a play on Tuesday of last week, and I have never been happier than I am right now. But if I had to go into rehearsal last year, I don't know what would have happened. I think I may have had to check myself into a hospital. That's the realness.
And something that you, I'm sorry, go ahead, Rachel.
No, I was just talking with another directing colleague, a woman named Ellie Heyman, and she was bringing up this idea that I think for her came from a visual arts professor, but this idea of seasons, and that it's actually very appropriate to have all the different seasons. And I was like, I like that, and I just wanted to declare it a winter in my soul. Not in the sense of death, but in the sense of replanting and like seeding and letting the soil. Because I've been thinking a lot about that, the line from Vanya, I've grown boring. And that's maybe a kin version to what you're saying in terms of like you weren't feeling the love or joy. Is I just was like, I feel very boring right now. So I've just been trying to take in other people's art for a couple hours every day, whether that's reading or seeing a show or going to museums.
Something else I'd just like to throw out there, which is, the going from the not-for-profit world into the commercial world, I don't know if there's anything as exhausting as directing your first Broadway play. For so many reasons, because, the things that you have to fight for with when your choices and your artistic manifestation involves maybe a producer not getting that piece of profit in their pocket is unlike anything a lot of us have spent our lives doing. So you find yourself fighting for things. I mean, and when I say fighting for things, I mean like life force arguing for things that you never believed you would be arguing about, which is like a 4-hour paint call before photos, you know, because the money that they're going to spend on that paint call is actually taking away from their profits. So there's, you know, when you've been running through the fields of the not-for-profit process and collaboration, it's extremely jarring to suddenly have every part of your show, people are doing math. You know, so that's that, you must recover from that, I think. And then also, like, you know, the star part of it, and there's just, it's just a lot of, you know, these are the things no one ever tells you. It's very grueling if you, you know, actually deeply inside of you yourself think of this as an art form. The marketplace can really slap you around, so.
I've got one more question before we open up to the floor for questions from the audience, but I just wanted to piggyback off what was said earlier about, you know, a playwright can send their script around, an actor has the attention of a rehearsal room or an audition room. How do directors vouch for their own work, and what is that, how does, I guess social media would play a big role in that today, maybe, of sharing your work and you know, getting from one job to the next. How do you put yourself out there?
I mean, I think I've just spent the past 5 hours watching clips of choreographers' work online, and I've been doing this nonstop pretty much for the past 3 weeks. So certainly video online is helpful as, like, I mean, it just is a future that people do that. I don't have a website, and I'm not doing that, but I think in terms of if I was a director coming up now, I would probably have a website. Oh, I hate that. Ugh, sorry. But I think the best thing is people talking about you. I mean, it's why, in a good sense, actually, the ecosystem I find to be so healthy is the more, I mean, I just never stopped being in someone's room, whether it was my room or someone else's room, being in your room, I just, like, whatever room I could be in. I love what you said, that you just go to tech, because I love tech. It's the best. So the more that you are part of a community, the more you are a part of a community. And ultimately, like, I think you can think really poorly of the, it's all who you know is who's going to hire you. But then on the flip side, it's like, well, why would you hire someone who you don't trust? And you, if you are in the position to hire, it is your moral responsibility to not be lazy about who you know. I actually think in some ways this question isn't asked enough of artistic directors, producers, of who their ecosystem is, and they grow boring. And then as a director now, who I get to hire people, that is my responsibility to constantly know more artists who I should be working with or curious about or seeing their work. But this thing of, like, knowing as many humans as possible, I think is a really big part of ultimately, like, being someone that someone calls when someone drops out of a gig, which is how I got my first series of jobs, was someone dropping that gig.
It might be true that your audience is predetermined. In other words, before you were born, it's already been decided what size an audience you have and who they are. In other words, you make your work and that audience that was predetermined comes to you. Silence.
I think of what that
means.
That's
a great way to end that.
I think there's a desperation to find audiences that is really unattractive. I think websites are sometimes really unattractive.
Totally.
And that desperation won't get you very far. And I'm a big believer in revolutions in small rooms, that whatever you do in a small room, and it's a great example with Natasha Pierre. how it started in a small room and just didn't fit in that room and got bigger and bigger. So you try to create as much volatility in that small room as possible. And if it needs to be bigger and have a bigger audience, it will happen.
Yeah, for me, the website, I think in the best of circumstances, is someone has your name and you want to check them out. But it's not about serving that or pushing that necessarily. Yeah. But
one thing I would say to directors who are trying to make their way, is that it really is about relationships. It's such a cliche to say, but you know, you've got to start building relationships with people. If you're not going to start your own company, you have to start building relationships with people who can hire you. Yeah. So you know, if you're early on, I think sitting down and having a coffee with a literary manager is good, because when they're looking for a director for a reading, they can think of you. If the playwright doesn't have a director attached to it, sitting down for a coffee with writers, but a lot of heartbreak lives there if you're an early director, because writers' careers move faster than directors' careers. So you know, their play will get a slot, and you might not go with it. But that's just what it is. And then, you know, eventually being able to sit in rooms with associate artistic directors and then artistic directors. And just knowing that you're never asking for a job, you're asking for a dialogue and a relationship, and it will probably pay off in a few years. Mm. But you have to stay in touch with them and let them know what you're doing. I mean, this is like just so boring, but it's the business part of it. If you are going to be a person who is a freelance director and doesn't want to start their own thing.
Great. I do see some hands pulled out.
So. Time for about 10 minutes of questions. Here, I'll start in the front.
Hi. So I have a question for all of you. I think as young directors who are at university levels, who are kind of in an isolated bubble of ecosystems that may not branch out into the greater world, how do you find yourselves inside the ecosystems that are larger cities like New York or Boston or Chicago? Where do you find that connection?
I mean, the good thing is if of course it will branch out into the outer world. You just may not be experiencing it yet, but you all will graduate, and who knows where people trickle. Thank goodness, or blossom, or whatever. And then seeing stuff, being in people's rooms. I mean, I see theater 5 or 6 nights a week. And I had the great fortune of going to school in New York City, where I really could see something 5 or 6 nights a week, whether that was dance or comedy or theater, or perform more. Typically, I was seeing more experimental stuff. But just more than anything, what Lisa was saying of building relationships, I mean, you can begin doing that now while you're in school if you want, with outside rooms, just by volunteering or ushering or doing whatever you can to, more than anything, get a free ticket.
I also think that when you're in undergrad or even grad school, it's a time not to be careful. Like, do outrageous things instead of waiting till you think you know what you're doing. Because you actually nobody ever knows what they're doing. They just get braver about doing it when they don't know what they're doing. And so you want to actually make a lot of noise with your friends and do things that feel kind of stupid and risky. I don't mean risky to the physical well-being or health, but artistically risky, because this is your chance to be artistically risky. And that will determine what kind of phone calls you get in the future. You know, people always think, if I do all the right things now, eventually I can do the big crazy things. But actually, you have to do the big crazy things now, because if you don't do them now, people will think of you and say, you know, 20 years of that thing. What's your name? What's your first name?
My name is Rachel.
So Rachel, they'll say, let's call Rachel. Do you want this phone call? Which is, Rachel, you like new plays. Do you want to do a new play reading? Or do you want somebody to call you and say, Rachel, well, they won't do this 20 years from now. They'll say, Rachel, what do you want to do? Clearly, you want to get the second phone call. or email or whatever one's doing in those days 20 years from now. So you have to start the process of creating those phone calls now, and don't wait for the chance to do risky big stuff. Because when can you? And it's all free, because your friends aren't going to ask to be paid right now.
We have some questions from Facebook. Deep, you want to read one of them?
Sure. I'll read this one because it got a couple of likes. Catherine Silverman from Facebook asks, as an early career director, how do you find opportunities beyond creating your own? How can you build your resume to catch up to catch the eye of a potential collaborator with minimal credits?
Just what I said a minute ago.
Just answer it. That's what she said.
Hi, I'm really interested in how we mentor the next generation, and I'm really interested in finding ways to help directors have the conversation about the work we do with our assistants and with the next generation. And when you look at, say, our union and the observership, it gets you in the room if you're an AD, but it sort of doesn't guarantee you anything, right? And then for most training programs, they mandate an assistantship, but again, whatever that ends up being is sort of luck of the draw, depending on who's paired and how the senior director sort of takes you under their wing or doesn't. But I would kind of love to create a series of talking points or some way for us to have the conversation in the moment through our process to let somebody into what we're doing. Does that make sense? How do you have a way that you interact with your assistant directors or that you approach sort of the mentorship of a senior director to an assistant?
I think the best thing you can do with everybody you're working with, and it's where they learn, is you turn to them and say, what do you think?
It's also a good test to see if they've been paying attention. I'm sorry, I think that's actually quite an important question, and I think it's something that people on this panel, you know, care a lot about. Yeah. I know that I do. I always am looking to make sure that my assistants are people of color and or women. And I do take the mentorship part of it seriously because I never had that. You know, I reached out to some people when I was coming up and they were really not interested in giving me the time of day. So I think that, you know, I do participate in the SDC observership program. There have been times, like I did a play called Party People, which is about the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, where I had, I think, four young assistants and observers in that room. And I always make sure that we schedule time every week for like a Q&A, because it's a weird thing where you're just sitting silently in a room for a long, long time. And so I want to make sure that they have questions that can be answered, or we can, like, I can actually ask them what they're thinking. That's how I'll learn who they are and if they're, you know, if I can trust them with the next layer of work or whatever. I don't know. I think it's really important. I think it's part of my responsibility to take care of the future of the field. And one of the things I feel like I've always been fighting for is access, because this art form is an incredibly elitist art form. Every single part of the way that theater is structured is to keep you out if you can't afford things. You know, part of the reason I never assisted was because I couldn't afford it. So I'm always looking to figure out how to like deal with class in this art form. It's really important to me. Mm-hmm.
I support everything that you said. I will definitely get into arguments with theaters if they don't have the budget for an assistant.
Same.
It's a huge thing that I advocate for.
Yep.
And I think the only other thing I would add is being then present for ongoing conversation with an assistant, always, that relationship is not project specific. Mm-hmm. And the seeing of the work is for me the most important. My rule always with my assistants is you may not assist me if you have the opportunity to do your own work. And I will always make space for you to come back to the project. But that is the top priority. And so anything that I can do to help that happen, I'm less good about asking what they think because I'm sort of, I just am typically so consumed just trying to get out what I think. But I'm always, what I want to know is what work they want to make and where I can see it and how I can help them make that work, definitely.
We have a question right here.
From your own experiences or those you've observed, the pros and cons of someone self-producing in order to get those especially early on, director credits.
I think a director is a producer. And if you cut that part out of you, you won't get very far. And speaking personally, I self-produced so many years in a row downtown, and every year I'd go, I can't do it again. I just can't. Okay, one more year I'll self-produce. And it really required a lot of self-producing. But I think that the self-producing actually gives you the muscles to be able to walk into foundations and find partnerships with people through describing your work into existence and asking for help and financial assistance and every other kind of assistance. But I think self-producing is much better than assisting.
I think that I agree with that. And I also think, is there anyone who hasn't I mean, I'm trying to think of like a direct, it's such a good, the pros and cons is such an interesting question because I feel like it's almost moot because it's like, I don't know self-produced.
And it's a pain in the ass, isn't it?
It sucks. And some of us are better than others. You guys are so much better. I was like, I forgot that you had like to have a till. Yeah. You know what I mean? I had no like change for people. I mean, it was like my self-production was like terrible, but you have to do, I literally don't know how else you do it.
More Facebook question?
Yeah, when a young director says, I can't get a job, I say, well, then you're not directing. Because part of your job is to make work happen. Mm-hmm. You just have to figure it out. And eventually it'll get taken over for you, but you have to learn that. So it's not true that you're out of a job. A director's never out of a job.
Mm-hmm. Clarissa Felt from Facebook asks, how much dramaturgy do you feel you integrate into your directing? And how do you feel about working with dramaturgs?
I feel like those are two different questions, mm-hmm. right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that part of my job as a director is to dramaturg. I mean, yeah. I think that's just, yeah. And whether it's what, Anne, what you're saying, which I agree with, I think the best way, that's what I do too. I go in and say, this is a perfect script, but how do I do this? Also because I'm not as smart as Lisa Peterson to say, like, there's a problem in that second act or whatever.
Well, yeah, I envy her.
Yeah, that's really quite a talent. So that there's different ways I think that we dramaturg, you know, but I definitely think it's part of, I think putting something up in 3D is a dramaturgical, you know, thing. And how I like to work with drama, it depends on the dramaturg, and it depends on the agenda of the dramaturg. Sometimes that's a really amazing relationship, and sometimes it feels like a third wheel. And sometimes it feels disruptive, and sometimes it can be great. And I think it definitely depends on who that dramaturg is and what the project is.
I'm going to have to come forward a little bit.
Hi. I'm interested in going forward in my career, really curating a space for the creation of work and really fostering the sort of community where you talk about, you know, trusting the people you know and really knowing the people you know and also creating space for access. And so I guess my question is, like, what are the first steps to sort of creating?
You just did it by saying it. I'm going to create a space.
Yeah.
But I don't want to cut off that question because it's a good question, but I think that just saying it out loud in a microphone is really great. Because I start thinking,
we need to know your name.
Yeah, we need to know your name and number. I'd like to go work with you.
Yeah, Facebook. Because now Facebook, everyone knows that this woman is looking for a community.
Give us your name. Yeah.
Leora.
What's your last name? Leora.
Okay, Leora Randall Tovori. Okay, we'll link to that. All right, right here in front. Hi.
What I'd like to hear from each of you is why do you do this? What drives you? What do you like to do? For me, as a director, it's about storytelling, about compelling stories that I have to tell. And I'm just curious, what drives you?
I'm going to say that that has changed over the years. And I would say the past 5 years, I'm very selfish about what drives me. I use the theater to figure out who I am. So I pick projects that help me explore things I don't understand about myself and things I don't understand about the world. And so I essentially am getting paid to self-actualize.
So good. I think right now I'm probably most driven by the people who I want to be in a room with. And which typically is a combination of people who I know are going to think very differently about a topic that is at the center of a piece. But I'm interested in, becoming... I'll use the word smarter, and I mean that, I guess, in a really comprehensive way. I mean that emotionally and intellectually and spiritually, but I want to leave every project being a richer human. So that's probably what drives me.
Yeah, it is kind of similar, right? Yeah.
I'm driven by anger and revenge. Seriously, I mean, I'm a nice person. People like working with me, but I'm nice because I'm able to channel the anger that I have in life into a really beautiful art form that I'm absolutely in love with. But I'm so angry about the world. And revenge, you know, the first half of my career was based on revenge against my parents who thought I couldn't do anything. And the second half was revenge against the critics who never understand anything. But that anger and revenge is such a fertile place.
Don't go on Facebook, you'll be wasting your energy.
I try not to. Yeah, thank you.
I also am driven by rage and love, I guess, equally. Rage and love equally. And I feel, like Annie, it changes. Right now, I feel just the need to challenge everyone on everything all the time. That's it. Just challenging.
And rage.
Yeah, but you know, the love is real. It's very deep. It's you know, it's how I survive.
Hey, Lisa, how's it
Hi.
Going? So a lot of the time there are a lot of white people, and I'm addressing that word very particularly because they seem to be the ones in positions of power
yes.
at like institutions that talk about wanting people of color in the room.
Right.
And then they'll have like symposiums with like other white people where they talk right. about wanting people of color in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it's a never ending cycle of just like white people talking about wanting diversity and they never do it. How did you, right, as a woman of color, like go about making sure that you were in those rooms
right.
to get things like The Good Negro, like Party People, like Eclipse? Like, how did you go about making sure that your voice was heard in these rooms and like being taken seriously in this room?
Thank you for that question. It's never-ending saga. Because as you say, they say they want you there, but they don't really want you there, is my experience. There was a moment where I felt like I wanted to start my own theater company, but then I realized what actually goes into it, and I thought it was really important because I was looking around and I realized I was one of the few still doing, that looked like me doing what I was doing, and I thought what was really important is that I put my face in front of artistic directors and insist that they hire me. That I wasn't going to be hiring myself or fundraising for myself, or I wasn't going to be in that hustle, that I was actually going to be a force for change by making people pay me to do the work. You know what I mean? And so that was why, like with The Good Negro, Tracy and I started working on that show when it was just a paragraph. You know, she and I clicked at, why I say reach out to playwrights is, you know, you got to find the people that are interested in telling the same stories. And, you know, we worked on that like this. But, I, you know, the whole thing is political. The whole thing for me is activism. So, for example, I was an associate casting director at New York Theatre Workshop, you know, back in the day. That was something that I had a fellowship there, and that was... And I, every time there were submissions, I would pull all of the resumes of women whose names I couldn't pronounce, or that people couldn't pronounce, because I felt like these were the invisible women. They represented what I felt like. And so that's where I first met Uzo Aduba, and Adepero Oduye, and Danai Gurira, and these people who are my people now. You know, when nobody, Zainab Ja, Pascal Armand, you know, when we were all invisible people. But, you know, it's always about reaching out to making space for, I always say you gotta take space to make space, right? So that's the one component, is the fighting for your community and fighting for the voices of those of that community, and then insisting over and over and over again that and calling people out. You know, I that's one thing that Facebook is good for. You know, and there's certain places that I know won't hire me because I've called them out, but that is okay because they don't have to hire me, but maybe they will hire Liliana. You know what I mean? Because I called them out. So it's the whole thing is we can't pretend that it's not there. There are places in the city that are bastions of whiteness and that suck up resources and real estate, and they will not let us in. And that is a fact. So, you know, we have to never ever stop naming it. And that's all. But, you know, fortunately we have language now, like white supremacy, you know, that allows us to actually codify it. So it's not just a feeling we have, it's an actual fact.
So. You had another, you well really spoken. Wanted to, you see there's, yeah, one more Facebook and one more in the crowd.
You have to take up space to make space. Okay.
Greg Strasser asked, how does one approach you all to assist? Do you take a chance on people you don't know, or do you prefer to have a relationship with someone before you trust them to assist? And how do you use your assistance?
I don't work with anyone I don't know, but that might be the form of a coffee. I'm looking at you like you asked the question deep, even though I know it came from that computer. I mean, emails, it tends to be a long process. I tend to want to be interested in the person who is interested in working with me. So it's a lot of me asking them questions, and it's why I like coming back to, what are you making? What are you making in a closet? I don't care what scale that's happening on. In fact, I'm probably most interested in what's happening in a closet. Yeah, and then everything from notes to communication center. That's what I have come, that was the Broadway revelation for me, was the amount of communications that needed to be happening, because you're running, and I actually mean this in a good sense, but you're the head of a factory.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that we're making art, like someone in Reading is making a widget, and I care about that job as much as I care about the other job. But definitely, like, my assistants have come to be my communication nerve center for any given project I'm working on.
I'm gonna, it's a dirty little secret that I have, which is I don't care if my assistant's a good director. I don't know, I don't, yeah. What they have to do is know how to take notes really well, not irritate me. And I don't know if that's going to happen until I'm in the process with them. I mean, I do have a coffee. I want to know that I want to think. I want to at least imagine or like have some sort of sense that they're not going to annoy me. It's about halfway through rehearsal, or maybe three quarters of the way through rehearsal, right before we go into tech. That's when I start to know who this person is, and just because they've been around enough, and I will turn to this person and ask, what do you think, if I am interested in what they have to say. But honestly, I want them to be a really good note taker and to take the notes the way that I ask them to take the notes and to deliver the notes the way that I ask them to deliver the notes. And that sounds really horrible, but from that actually comes quite a bit, because if that's what they know their job is, other things come out secretly. They don't have to pretend to try to sound smart around me in a way that there's a pressure that's off, that then I get to understand who they are really. And I have had great relationships. Lauren, you're here somewhere, aren't you? There you are. Lauren is a great example, you know, who I just grew to totally adore. I wasn't making any promises at the beginning, and it, you know, and there wasn't any pressure. And you know, a relationship isn't forced. It's just sort of like grows out of it. And some ADs I ask what their opinion is, some I don't. But I care about mentorship as well, and I find it very important to have people even past the time have access to me. It's a growing family. And the problem is I have a very big family now with all of the ADs, and I don't have a lot of time. So I'm trying to figure that. That's actually a real problem, because not all directors allow the kind of access I think I allow, because I think it's important. But then how do I continue to be helpful to Lauren? You know, that's a question.
I think we have time for one more, and I think you've got it.
Anne, I feel like you were already starting to answer this a little bit, but as someone who is like trying to self-produce as much as possible and do readings and has started to make some connections with directors who are working like crazy and probably on the path to burnout, who are, you know, super busy, who have been like, stay in touch, but then it's hard to get in contact with them. I'm just curious what your practical thoughts are and like how much to be in touch, like how, like what feels like too much to you, how much do you want to be reached out to, any other advice for relationship building within the field, knowing that so many people are spread so thin?
It's such a good question. And I think I don't know, I can't speak to how these guys feel, but I can tell you how I feel. I say don't stop emailing me. I forget. I have a lot of emails. If I'm not answering, it's not because I hate your gut. You know what I mean? I think persistence is really, really important. Now, I will probably, if someone is, I will have my own way of letting you know if it's too much or whatever, and I assume that every director would. But I think, I'll tell you, I'll try to make this quick. A little story, when I was assisting David S. Bjornsson at Classic Stage Company, I remember that we kept getting letters from this one guy over and over again. He wanted to do readings, he wanted to assist, he wanted to do this, he wanted to do that. And I remember David being like, oh God, this guy is driving me crazy. And I, you know, this guy's driving me crazy. And you know, that guy became the next artistic director of CSC. And that was a huge lesson for me. Barry Edelstein. And I'm sure David, right. Dave, you know, I mean, whatever, but like, but that was a really important lesson. I was like, I get it. And we're all so timid, right? Like, ooh, I don't want to bother that person. Fuck it. You know, we all get like a million things all the time. People, you know what I mean? I just keep emailing.
Don't say in the email that you want to have coffee. Because I don't know about you guys, but it's like if you think you had coffee with all the people who want to have coffee, get sick. Just ask the question. It's like, do you get that? Like, let's have coffee. No, like, ask the question.
I do pretty regular.
Coffee. I know you're.
I do like coffee. I do pretty.
I like coffee too, but I can't
drink that
much. I
do pretty regular group coffees because I don't have time for as many individual coffees. But I just now organize like a group coffee. I'll do like one a month if I'm
fantastic.
Here for a long
I'm
period
gonna do
of time.
That now. That's
really good. We thank you for the time you've taken tonight. This is a great panel. Thanks for coming out, everybody. Anne, Rachel, Anne, and Liesl, and Allison. Thanks so much.
Thank you.